Good evening. It's not often we have a whole house full. This is great. Let's do introductions around.
Forrest.
Julie.
Melissa.
Randy.
Donald Lynn.
Nathan.
Ron.
Samuel.
Ritu.
Britt.
Isabel.
Ben.
Ellie.
Wendy.
Bob.
And Andy. Nathan, have you been here before?
Mm-hmm.
I thought not. How did you hear about us?
Online.
I see. We've just gotten online in a new way through Sweeping Zen, if you all know about that. And Adam Tebbe is putting together a collection of interviews with Zen teachers. And he's begun to address Koban's lineage. So Ian is on there, and I think Carolyn's on it, and he just put me on it too. So it's been very interesting. Lots of very cogent questions. What about compassion? What about saving all sentient beings? It was wonderful exercise. I really learned a lot. And you'll meet a lot of other Zen teachers on that site also. We're just about in the middle of, maybe a little past the middle now. Trust in mind, which I've just noticed this day, that has a subtitle, The Rebellion of Chinese Zen. I don't know what he means by that exactly. I suppose this is about the third patriarch, the third ancestor in China, who nobody knows very much about, actually. But he stepped forward with this little poem that we've inherited that's lasted all these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, which is trying to point us back to where we live, help us to drop our distractions in a way. So we've come to the last one we did was obey the nature of things, meaning your own nature. Obey your own nature, and you will walk freely and undisturbed. So that brings up the question, what is my nature? What is it to obey? Does that mean buying a chocolate eclair every time I walk past the bakery window? Or going off to Rio because it sounds like a real good idea? We have a lot of wants and desires that are certainly a part of our nature, but I don't believe that's what he means. Your own nature, the nature of things, you will walk freely. Actually, your own nature has no real needs. Our own nature feels how well we are and how at home we already are. And how much we're given. And that's what gives us the freedom to walk in that way. So the next one is number 36. When thought is in bondage, the truth is hidden, for everything is murky and unclear. And the burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. And this is his big subject, how our mind is always making judgments, constantly putting a value on each thing. Well, this is good, but that's better. That's terrible. Even figuring out what's high and what's low is all arbitrary. It's how we work up our own relationship with ourself. Well, if high is good and low is bad, then obviously I will try to identify myself with the high part and be mean to the low part or turn away from it or in some way, through our judgment, create a very bumpy world. In a world that is completely even, where in the end all value is the same. We're just making it up, creating those highs and lows, and goods and bads. It makes us feel more secure, but the truth, and he's talking about what's true, the truth in bondage is hidden by all these bumps, all these ways that we create a self for ourselves. When in fact, our self, as we are untroubled and unjudgmental, includes everything and everyone. Doesn't mean we like everything and everyone. It doesn't mean that we go floating off into some nether world. It means that we are right here where we are and deal with what's here rather than whatever our complicated value system is throwing up. Burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. It's really a state of ignorance. And ignorance is one of the three, our three great difficulties, you could say. Anger and greed and ignorance. And they're all based on the same thing, on a false identity. So I get rid of, try to get rid of, or I don't like, or I'm angry about the things that don't fit in my picture of what this world is and who I am. And the things that feel like they enhance my beautiful image, I want a whole lot more of. So that's anger and greed. And ignorance is just not seeing what's really here. Not being willing to see. And we all suffer from blinders. So, of course, Zazen practice is a great gift to us because we can't distract ourselves with all the likings and dislikings and judgments. When we sit down, we begin to see what's going on. And it's a real busy, it really is annoying and wearying. It's exhausting, really. And we begin to see in Zazen, wow, it's amazing what's going on in there. And all the time the world is, the traffic is going by and the wind is blowing and the sun is going down and we're just here breathing together just the way things are. It's quite amazing. And it doesn't mean that we say, oh, this is terrible, what's going on. It's just that we see how it is with us. And we see what makes us happy and what's really difficult. So he goes on, number 37, what benefit can be derived from distinctions and separations? And this made me think of what I'm reading, my going to bed reading these days, or my already in bed reading, as I always have something that I can dip into for maybe 5 or 6 pages and then turn out the light. And it's Thoreau's journal. He had a journal that was huge, many, many volumes. But someone has gone through and picked out all his favorite parts of it. And it's about this thick. It's a few inches thick. It's quite a large book. And it's absolutely wonderful. And the wonderful part of it is how much he loved the world he was in and how curious he was about everything. He would notice when a flower was blooming, a particular flower, and look up its Latin name. And then he would notice next year whether it came at the same time or a little earlier or later. Not in an obsessive way at all, but in a way of saying, oh, there you are, my friend. Everything in the woods was his friend. And the other side of it was that he couldn't understand why not everybody was like that. And why people were just so caught up in how much money they made and what their jobs were and all of that. He said, but they could be out in the woods, and it's so wonderful out here. So this doesn't mean the distinctions and separations are about making value judgments, not about recognizing your brothers and sisters wherever you go, in the grass and the stones and the traffic and your life. And the more distinct, the more we recognize and can separate out our world, the more wonderful it becomes. If we see it as a blur, which often we do because we're in so much of a rush, our culture is so busy and so fast that we don't stop to see a little flower, or even someone walking down the sidewalk. We pass friends because we are so busy. Thoreau was walking in the woods and suddenly he saw a little owl. And without thinking, he just grabbed it and wrapped it up in his handkerchief and took it home and put it in a cage and looked at it all night, and then talked about how he held on to the little stick in the cage and how he looked at him and how he never closed his eyes. And they created a real relationship. So when he took him out and took him back the next day, the little owl didn't want to go away. It kept looking at him. It's like, you mean I'm supposed to go now? So it was that kind of relationship. Very particular. And it's what's in all of us. It's that heart connection. So number 38 says, if you wish to move in the one way, do not dislike even the world of sense and ideas. And that's what I mean. Of course, we have a life. It's a wonderful life. But avidya actually means no light. So you can see that ignorance means we're not willing to see or able to see. He quotes, Musang quotes a Zen poem that says, good and evil have no self-nature. Holy and unholy are empty names. Spring comes, grass grows by itself. In front of the sense door is the land of stillness and light. Of course, we can bring up the whole question of good and evil. And it's easily misunderstood that everything is relative and therefore we don't have to worry about anything, when in fact the very first precept, the first pure precept is stopping all evil and practicing good. That was Buddha's first teaching in the Four Noble Truths. But what he said was, when evil comes up, in the very moment when it comes up in our mind, we stop it. It doesn't mean go out with a sword and take on the whole world. It means how we are with our own mind, how we can be with what's good. If there's something that is really working for us, we can cultivate that and deepen it and widen it and make it more available. And the parts that we see that aren't so wholesome, aren't so helpful, we don't have to beat ourselves up about it, but we can certainly not cultivate it. Just see it for what it is. A mistake. Pretty natural. We're very messy creatures, really. We'd like to sort of pull ourselves up and polish ourselves up and be all better. But our best way is really to allow ourselves to stay on the ground and just see how we actually are. And live from that place. Be really honest. It's a little embarrassing sometimes, but that's okay. It's more alive. The more we try to be something that we're not, the less vitality and life there is in us. So the next line is number 39, which Musang calls the most crucial line. It's very short. It says, indeed, to accept the world of sense and ideas fully is identical with true enlightenment. So maybe Thoreau was a completely enlightened ancestor of ours. A delightful one. To completely accept the world of sense and ideas rather than picking and choosing. As this poem starts out saying, picking and choosing is going to get us in trouble. So here he's saying, a mind that is willing to accept. And it's not an overall picture either. We can't say, I accept the universe or I accept everything, because everything is moving and changing all the time. But we can accept where we are and who we are, wherever we are and whenever we are, like right now. That's what it's about. It's not so fancy. It's not so easy either. So he goes on to say, it's about letting things unfold according to their own nature. rather than according to our preferences, because they will unfold according to their nature anyway. Sometimes that's hard to accept if it's something that we really, really don't like. At least in my experience, that's certainly true. And yet they do unfold just the way that they unfold. It's like how Koban translated saving all sentient beings. We vow to save all sentient beings. But Koban said sentient beings will save themselves. It's completely allowing it. It's not saying I don't care. It's the opposite. It's caring completely and trusting completely. There's another translation for these few little words that goes, use your senses to experience reality, for they are part of your empty mind and notices everything and is guided by its needs. So it's not like we step off a cliff into the empty air and have no relationship with anything anymore. Acceptance means just allowing our own mind to find its own balance and equanimity and way. It means giving ourselves time. Can't just say, okay, mind, let's just crack the whip and say, okay, we've got to do this thing. It's about completely surrendering to one's own life and letting it be as it wants to be. And again, Zazen is the very first way and the most best way of doing that. So the last one is of this little set. The wise person strives to no goals, but the foolish person fetters himself. When Adam Tebbe asked me about goals, he said, does Zen have a goal? And I said, well, yeah, the goal is to get to the Zendo. The goal is to try not to fall off the cushion, which is what Koban always said. We do have these little goals, but otherwise, no goal. No attainment. With nothing to attain, the Bodhisattva depends on wisdom, her own inherent self-nature. So that worked out pretty well. Sometimes these say a lot of different things, but this is kind of a nice package. So are there questions? Discussion? Donna Lynn?
Could I ask you to read the verses again?
The whole thing?
Where you started tonight.
Oh, sure.
And ended.
Yes. What benefit can be derived from distinctions and separations? If you wish to move in the one way, do not dislike even the world of... Oh, that's way in the end. Wait a minute. Oh, I guess it's not. If you wish to move in the one way, do not dislike even the world of sense and ideas. Indeed, to accept them fully is identical with true enlightenment. The wise person strives to no goals, but the foolish person fetters himself. Musong says the foolish person is the consumer who derives his or her identity from consumptive accumulations. And that these consumptive accumulations become fetters. It's true. It's true. I know people my age and older who are trying to get rid of stuff now. They spent a whole lifetime collecting beautiful things, lots and lots of nice things. And then when you get older, you realize what a burden it is. What am I going to do with all this stuff? It really is a fetter. But even the acquisitive mind, there's a little fine line between Thoreau's catching the owl out of, delight, and just getting stuff for the sake of filling an empty place inside, which often consumption is, at least in my experience. I always say the three poisons, so-called, are, we all have greed, hatred, or anger, and delusion, or ignorance. But we specialize in one or the other, often. And I certainly specialize in the greed side. And I know what that is, that there's that feeling that there's something incomplete, and that something, a new book, or a cookie, or something will make this fill up. And of course, it doesn't do that at all. It's just an illusion. Julian?
Those, I guess you could call the negative aspect. I mean, there's all... it seems to, like, turn. I mean, you accumulate stuff, you get rid of it,
Yes.
I mean, in that way, I don't know, it's kind of the whole distinction between evil, and it's like the nervous life finds a time for
it does. It does. I always say that we should move. Everybody should move every 7 years, because then you just get rid of everything and start over. Yeah. But we don't do that. Anything else?
We've got greed, hatred, and delusion. You hear those three. But aren't greed and hatred also contained within delusion? Are they not?
Yes.
The delusion is the whole thing springs from.
Yes, it does.
In the greed, you know, the world is just more. Let's win. Let's acquire. Let's, you know, you see bumper stickers. The one who dies with the most toys wins. And I know for myself, you know, it's whatever, however my delusion manifests, it's always acquiring. It's trying to get some, it's always trying to fill the hole. The empty thing, right? That When I get that, whatever that is,
that's not doing.
I'm going to be full. I'm going to be complete then.
Yeah.
So, well, now that I got that, well, no, I just got to get that. Just sitting.
Yeah. Yeah. So in sitting, if we sit long enough, we end up sort of kissing ourselves goodbye. That part of ourself, because we don't need that anymore. It becomes a kind of a different intention. Maybe the whole thing is a hole, too big to fill, or something like that. In any case, it's a very humbling thing. We don't have to exalt ourselves in some way, or Koban's master said, please be like a table with one shorter leg. You know, because he was always trying so hard to do it right, and at the same time he was struggling with all these things, and his master said, take it easy. You can be wobbly. It's okay. It's hard to accept that we can just be kind of our own natural born idiot self rather than, you know, something special. And the effort to be special is what entangles us.
I'll just Shanti put it once when I thought it was very interesting. He's that sense of I'm not enough.
Yes.
And he said, And I always look at it from a low self-esteem point of view. I'm not enough, you know, this poor image,
yeah,
the me image. But his comment was, that sense I'm not enough is just a statement of the obvious.
It's the truth.
You're not enough.
Yes.
And when you're okay with that, then you're okay.
That's what, you know, I was saying, yes.
It's this trying to be something, this ego accept. Oh, I got my Prajna Parami shirt on, by the way.
Is that Einstein?
Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. And trying to be something.
Yes.
Is the reinforcement of the belief that I'm not, enough.
Yes.
No delusion springs forth.
Exactly.
There's a distinction between wanting the idea of something.
Yes.
Being that something.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, a lot of people want to be, I don't know, whatever kind of skill you think of. And they just love the idea of playing the piano, but they can't get the focus to practice for whatever reason. There's a lack of interest, or I don't know, their nature is not really into it, but the idea, they hold on to this idea.
Yes. Yeah, it's the ideas that trip us up.
That's a good word. The way you express their nature is not really. I have a friend that it's like he has to believe that he can accomplish anything, because anything that he thinks he can't do is like it's like he interprets it as I'm a failure because of. I go, no, it's just you're not interested. It's okay. You don't have to.
Yeah.
I like when you said your nature is not really, but you think you have to call it that trait.
Just another cheap thought. Yeah. Well, it's just 8:00. So, thank you all. I was thinking on the way down how honored I feel to be sitting with all of you. This is such a wonderful experience for me, and I appreciate it so much. I appreciate you all so much, how you quietly take care of everything and how you switch jobs, and everything just sort of is taken care of in a very, very nice way. And I just wanted to thank you all for all of this.